This is a Healing House broadcasting series, reading on a history of Cambodia. Fourth edition by David Chandler. Excerpt from David Chandler. A History of Cambodia. Episode 4. Yasovarman and his successors. Jayavarman II's son, Jayavarman III, came to the throne, hunted elephants, and died after ruling wisely in 877. The writer who provides this information had a special interest in continuity, after all, with regard to the Devaraja cult, for the Stok Kaktom inscription presumes, perhaps mistakenly, that the rulers who patronized the Devaraja cult were the legitimate and unique rulers of Cambodia. This may have become the case, especially after the middle of the 10th century, but it is interesting that Jayavarman III's successor, the first to embark on a systematic program of temples and inscriptions at Harihiralaya, made only one muted reference to this predecessor, tracing his own legitimacy to relatives of a wife of Jayavarman II, not Jayavarman III's mother, and to a pair of kings about whom nothing else has come to light. Presumably, this was a way of casting his genealogy far beyond Jayavarman's usurpation, thus connecting him with the pre-Angkorian rulers. In fact, it was this very king, Indravarman, R.877-89, who himself was a usurper, which may account for his muddled genealogy. His reign is important because it was the first of many to be marked by a triadic pattern of royal behavior described in the 1930s by the art historian Philippe Stern. The first phase was to sponsor irrigation works in honor of his subjects and the watery divinities of the soil. During Indravarman's reign, a large reservoir was constructed at Harihiralaya to trap rainwater. It was known as the Indratataka and covered 300 hectares, approximately 650 acres. An inscription tells us that as soon as Indravarman became king, he made this promise, "In 5 days, I will begin to dig." Another purpose of such reservoirs was to indicate the extent of a king's power and of his alliances with the gods, by recreating the geographical features associated in people's minds with Mount Meru, the mythical home of the gods, where lakes surround the central mountain. This North Indian fantasy, translated to waterlogged Cambodia, is not devoid of irony, but neither are Gothic towers. In many U.S. college towns, the second phase was for a monarch to honor his parents and his other ancestors by installing statues of them, usually in the guise of gods. Indravarman sponsored statues of his parents, as well as of others, including his mother's parents and Jayavarman II and his wife, all depicted as embodiments of Shiva and his consort, in the stuccoed brick temple complex known today as Priya Ko, Sacred Cow. This charming temple, completed in 879, inaugurated what is now called the Ralyuo style of Cambodian architecture. In this style, several features that were to become important later, including the custom of enclosing temples in a series of concentric moats and walls, appeared for the first time. The sophistication of the carving and the predominance of floral motifs suggest that these skills had been developed earlier by carving wood. Although of modest size in comparison with later temples, Indravarman's monuments of Priya Ko and Baikong, his temple mountain, were far more grandiose in conception and appearance than anything that had preceded them and hint at developments in religious ideology and social mobilization for which other evidence is lacking. An inscription from Priya Ko in battle, which is like a difficult ocean to cross, he raised a pathway, made up of the heads of his arrogant enemies, his own troops passed over on it, indicates that Indravarman had become a universal monarch by subduing unspecified contenders. As the inscription also tells us, it seems that the creator, Indra, tired of making so many kings, had fashioned this king named Indravarman, literally, protected by Indra, to form the joy of the three worlds, uniquely. Inscriptions far from Ralyuo suggest that Indravarman at least briefly commanded loyalties in northeastern Thailand and the Mekong Delta. One inscription, carved in honor of one of his teachers, himself a cousin of Jayavarman II, extends the earlier rhetoric, ruler of the entire world which he had conquered, established on the slopes of Mount Meru, he was even steadier than the sun, which occasionally was distant. Atop the lordly heads of the kings of China, Kampa and Yavadvipa, Java, his reign was like a flawless crown, made from a garland of jasmine flowers. Statements like this about kings, which may strike us as flowery, were circumscribed by the traditional characteristics of the gods which the kings were being made to resemble. The poet's skill was thought to consist of piling up these characteristics and half concealing some of them behind metaphors, similes, and puns. Just as the verses enumerated ways in which a king was like the god, the temples were catalogues and pictures of the world of the gods, a sort of mirror image. In this sense, the temples can be seen as puns, or plays on words, and mirror images of another world. The final phase of Indravarman's program, as detected by Philippe Stern, was to erect a temple mountain. This is now known as the Baikon, and it took the form of a stepped pyramid. Unlike the reservoir, or the Priako, the Baikon was dedicated to the king himself, and was to serve, after his death, as his sarcophagus. Coeds estimated that 13 Angkorian kings, beginning with Jayavarman II, built such temple mountains. Not all of them have survived, and those that have can be read in different ways. First, they were planned as duplicates of the mythical mountain, Mount Meru, which stood north of the Himalayas at the center of the universe. Like Mount Meru, they were homes for the gods and for deceased worthies, not only kings, who had been assimilated into heaven. They were also tombs, housing the ashes of the king. In some cases, particularly Angkor Wat, they were astronomical observatories as well. Baikon was the first Cambodian temple to be built primarily of stone rather than brick. It was also the first, with the possible exception of the 8th century temple of Akyem, to have a pyramidal shape. The temple was reconstructed by French archaeologists in the 1930s, but by then nearly all of its bas-reliefs had disappeared. Indravarman's son, Yasovarman, who reigned from 889 to about 910, was an important king. His inscriptions and his buildings suggest that he wanted to do more than his father did, and to focus Cambodia around a royal city. Yasodharapura, the city of Angkor, bore his name until it was abandoned in the 1500s. Yasovarman's first official action appears to have been to endow a 100 religious hermitages, equipping each with a royal rest house and a set of regulations. 12 nearly identical inscriptions related to these hermitages have been discovered. Two are near Ralulos. Six of the others are from southeastern Cambodia, where Yasovarman, through his mother, claimed family connections from pre-Angkorian times. The spread of the inscriptions suggests that Kambujadesa was becoming a recognized concept as well as an ideal. Soon after this, Yasovarman honored his parents by building four brick temples, now known as Loliai, on an island he built in the middle of his father's reservoir. At the northeast corner of the reservoir, a time-honored direction in Cambodian religious thinking, he built a raised highway running northwest toward the area 16 kilometers, 10 miles, away where he planned to establish his capital city. This area now houses the Angkor complex. Yasovarman's choice of Angkor was probably influenced by his plan to build his own temple mountain there on the summit of a natural hill. The choices available to him included a hill, Phnom Krom, that was too close to the Tunnel Sap, and another, Phnom Bok, that was too far away. He constructed small temples on these two hills, however, and built his main temple on the hill known today as Phnom Baikang, and then as Phnom Kandal, Central Mountain, which still lies close to the center of the Angkor complex. The Stok Kaktom inscription tells us that Yasovarman established the royal city of Sri Yasodharapura and brought the Devaraja from Hariharalaya to this city. Then he erected a central mountain, Phnom Kandal. Yasovarman's mountain was not identified as Phnom Baikang until the 1930s. In conception and execution, it is far more grandiose than any of his father's monuments. Its symbolism has been studied in detail by Jean Filiazat, who has shown that the number of levels, statues, towers, and stairways, when read separately and together, correspond to various numbers, particularly 33 and 108, endowed by Indian religion with metaphysical significance. In some cases, pilgrims approaching the monument would be able to catch this illusion by counting the number of towers they could see. To the east of Phnom Baikang, Yasovarman built a reservoir, the Yasodharatitaka, roughly 6.5 kilometers 4 miles long and 3 kilometers 2 miles wide. Along its southern shore, he had monasteries, built for sects that honored Shiva, Vishnu, and the Buddha. Elsewhere, throughout his kingdom, he ordered temples built on natural hills, the most notable being Priya Vihear, on the edge of the precipice that nowadays forms part of the frontier between Cambodia and Thailand. These activities suggest that Yasovarman was able to command a far larger pool of manpower than his predecessors had. Yasovarman's inscriptions show him to have been a cosmopolitan monarch, aware of the grandeur of Indian civilization and tolerant of different religious beliefs. As usual, however, the sources reveal very little about his political activities, his alliances, or his idiosyncratic ideology. We have tantalizing glimpses of administrative reforms, including evidence that, in Yasovarman's legal code, fines were levied in relation to one's ability to pay, and a suggestion that taxes were efficiently collected, in kind, throughout the kingdom. But for the most part, we must settle for proclamations of his greatness, such as he was a lion man, he tore the enemy with the claws of his grandeur, his teeth were his policies, his eyes were the Veda. His glory was like a roar in all directions, his virtues made up his name. Here, as so often in Sanskrit versification, many of the words are deliberate double entendres. The phrase his eyes were the Veda, for example, plays on the similarity between the verb to see and the noun sacred teaching. These double meanings, as we have seen, appear at many points in Angkorean verse as well as in the architecture of the temples. Yasovarman died around 910. He was succeeded in turn by two of his sons. Little is known about them, and by 921 a brother of one of Yasovarman's wives was established in a rival city at Koh Kur, in an inhospitable area about 100 kilometers, 62 miles, north of Angkor. The rival soon began to perform kingly actions, such as building a reservoir and beginning work on a temple mountain. In 928, when the reigning king died at Yasodharapura, the Koh Kur ruler proclaimed himself king with the title Jayavarman IV. Work continued on his temple mountain, known today as Prasat Tham, until about 930. The temple itself, housing a lingam estimated to have been 18 meters, 59 feet, high and about 5 meters, 16 feet, in diameter and probably made of metal, or encased in metal, for it has disappeared, was in fact the highest of the temples erected in Cambodia, with the exception of Angkor Wat. Jayavarman IV's inscriptions boasted that the construction surpassed those of previous kings. We do not know the basis of his colossal self-esteem, the nature of his following, or what prompted him to shift the capital from Yasodharapura. Although Jayavarman IV's extravagant claims may seem hollow or pompous to us, it is clear that, by force or persuasion, he was able to rule at Koh Kur over large numbers of people and in considerable splendor for 20 years. The site contains over 40 temples constructed in this short period. His influence may well have extended into what is now northeastern Thailand, where several temples in the Koh Kur style have survived. After his death in 942, one of his sons reigned briefly, and in 944. One of his nephews, on his mother's side, a nephew of Yasovarman as well, returned to Yasodharapura as King Rajendravarman II. In the words of a later inscription, this king restored the holy city of Yasodharapura, long deserted, and rendered it superb and charming by erecting houses there that were ornamented with shining gold, palaces glittering with precious stones, like the palace of Indra on earth. Although little is known about Rajendravarman's reign, his imitation of procedures enacted by Yasovarman, such as building a temple honoring his ancestors in the middle of a lake, indicates that he wished to restore Angkorean kingship rather than to start a dynasty of his own or to connect himself with Jayavarman's brief dynasty at Koh Kur. Under Rajendravarman, two elegant temple mountains, the Meban and Pri Rup, were built as well as numerous other temples, especially in the north. His reign appears to have been peaceful, except for a successful campaign against Kampa, and it ushered in a period of prosperity at Angkor that lasted for almost 100 years. One aspect of this prosperity is the literary polish of Rajendravarman's Sanskrit inscriptions. One of these, the Pri Rup stele, runs to almost 300 stanzas, glorifying Rajendravarman's genealogy, his learning, and his performance as king. Another aspect of his reign was the commercial expansion of the Khmer Kingdom westward into what is now northeastern Thailand. A third was his public tolerance of Buddhism. Rajendravarman appears to have studied Buddhism himself, and the minister in charge of public works throughout his reign was a prominent Buddhist. Rajendravarman died in 968 and was succeeded by his son Jayavarman V, who is still a boy and appears to have spent several years under the close supervision of relatives and high officials. These men and their families figure largely in the highly polished inscriptions that have come down to us from his reign. One of the loveliest of the temples in the Angkor region, now known as Banti Srey, Fortress of Women, was dedicated at the beginning of the reign by an official who was later Jayavarman's guru or tutor. There is evidence that this delicate, small-scale temple, carved of pinkish sandstone, once served an important urban area, about 16 kilometers, 10 miles, north of the main Angkor complex. In 1916, when the region was heavily wooded, the temple was discovered by a French surveying party. Although Shaivite like his father and many of the Brahmins at the court, Jayavarman V was tolerant of Buddhism, and Buddhist scholarship flourished during his reign. An elegantly written inscription from Wat Sither in Kampong Cham dating from this period shows how syncretic Buddhist thinking inside Cambodia had become, fusing elements of Buddhism and Shaivism in a way that led the 19th century scholar Emile Senart to note, "Everywhere one senses a manifest preoccupation to disturb people's habits as little as possible, and to submerge deep differences inside surface similarities." Inscriptions play down Jayavarman V's role as a builder of temple mountains. His own, the Takeo Temple, appears to be unfinished. Jayavarman V's death in 1001 ushered in a turbulent and destructive period, but by 1003, another king, whose origins are unknown, was reigning at Angkor although the rest of the kingdom was not under his control. In the north, a prince calling himself Suryavarman, later to be king as Suryavarman I, was mentioned in several inscriptions. Some scholars have argued that neither of these kings was Cambodian by blood. As Michael Vickery has recently shown, however, Suryavarman was almost certainly a Cambodian member of an elite family with links to the northeastern part of the kingdom. It is intriguing that the blueprint used by Suryavarman to take power in the first decade of the 11th century so closely resembles the one followed 2 centuries before by Jayavarman II. The process involved sporadic warfare, as well as the formation of coalitions by force, marriage, and cajolery that enabled the pretender to reduce or buy off the power of local chiefs. Vickery suggested that Suryavarman had powerful allies among the priestly families that dominated the government at Angkor, and inscriptions of the time show him moving slowly westward, toward a partly depopulated capital, over a period of years in itself an indication of the intricacy of his alliances. Suryavarman won his final battle, an inscription tells us, from a king surrounded by other kings. One new element in his rise to power is his patronage of Buddhism, although he apparently was not a Buddhist himself. There is evidence from hostile inscriptions that as he rose to power, he destroyed Vra, or religious images, but the meaning of this charge is unclear. Had Suryavarman been a Buddhist, the destruction might represent iconoclasm pure and simple. It is more likely that it was connected with the delegitimization of certain religious foundations whose patrons had been slow or unwilling to cooperate with him. Another inscription, in fact, suggests that during his reign the king deliberately impoverished members of the elite who had amassed great fortunes and thus represented distinct political threats. One of Suryavarman's first actions in reaching Yesodharapura was to arrange that an oath of loyalty be sworn to him publicly by as many as 4,000 officials, known as Tamvrak, at the newly constructed royal palace. The oath has survived in a lengthy inscription, the only one of its kind, that states that the officials will be loyal to the king and adds, "If all of us who are here in person do not keep this oath with regard to his majesty, may he still reign long, we ask that he inflict on us royal punishment of all sorts. If we hide ourselves in order not to keep this oath, may we be reborn in the 32nd hell as long as the sun and moon shall last." The oath ends by asking that those who keep it be awarded religious foundations to administer, as well as food for their families as recompense due to people who are devoted to their master. Loyalty, in other words, was to be rewarded by the right to extract surpluses from regions under some sort of control by Tamvraks, who were linked together by their allegiance to the king. The oath marks an intensification of royal power and also the imposition of a newly constituted, or reconstituted, elite connected to the control of land. Suryavarman's reign, in fact, was characterized by the intensification of several aspects of kingship, coming at a time when bureaucratic power rivaled or even surpassed the power of the king. Suryavarman expanded the territory under Ankarian control, colonizing the western end of the Tunnel Sap with new religious foundations. Further away, in the same direction, he annexed the Theravada Buddhist kingdom of Luvo, centered on present-day Lopburi in central Thailand. He also expanded the hydraulic works at Angkor. In a move that suggests that his other policies had increased the population of the city. Under Suryavarman, priestly and bureaucratic functions seldom separate in practice were institutionalized. Government-sponsored religious foundations became conduits for government revenue and largesse in ways that remain obscure, but that probably were connected with the power of priestly bureaucratic families around the king. His administration was an urbanizing one. A French scholar, Henri Mestrier du Bord, has shown that, whereas for the preceding three reigns roughly 20 toponyms contained in inscriptions end with the suffix pura or city, cf. Singapore, the Lion City, under Suryavarman the number jumped to 47, further evidence that his rise to power involved herding people into conglomerations from less tightly administered rural areas. Perhaps some of these pura were cities in name only, to enhance the prestige of locally based elites, but the evidence for urbanization coincides with other things we know about Suryavarman's reign. There is also evidence that merchants engaged in local and overseas trade became more active while Suryavarman was king. Throughout Cambodian history, the majority of such people appear to have been, in ethnic terms, outsiders Khams, Chinese, or Vietnamese, but references to merchants as a group are more frequent in inscriptions dating from Suryavarman's reign. As usual, foreign trade involved the exchange of wild goods from forested areas for civilized ones, such as cloth or porcelain, but as Kenneth Hall has shown, commodities such as land, rice, buffalo, and slaves were also traded by Cambodians at this time for manufactured or exotic goods from other countries. Interestingly, this economic activity occurred without any consistent units of value or any official currency, a fact that persisted well into Cambodia's middle period. The extent to which Suryavarman's reign mobilized bureaucratic and coercive talents to concentrate people at Yesodharapura marked a departure from the past, and the success of his tactics showed subsequent kings that the kingdom could be organized and expanded by forcing its cultivators to work throughout the year. The food needed to support the apparatus, priests, kings, bureaucrats, and armies, could not be supplied by the single annual harvests that previously had sufficed for ordinary people to survive. In extending his power in this way, Suryavarman enjoyed the advantages of a usurper. He was free to choose and reward his trusted followers, rather than finding himself hemmed in at the beginning of his reign by hangers-on from other courts. At first, governing the country with new officials probably meant that more attention was paid to local issues, for the new officials would still have debts to their clients in the countryside that their successors could ignore. Suryavarman's successor, Udayadityavarman II, r. 1050-66, was a devotee of Shiva. Guided by a powerful guru, he revived interest in the Devaraja cult and also revived the custom of building a massive temple mountain, the Bapuan, to house the lingam associated with his reign. As an inscription carved under his successor tells us, seeing that in the middle of Jambudvipa, the home of the gods, there rose up a golden mountain, he made a golden mountain in the center of his city, out of emulation. On the summit of this mountain, in a golden temple, shining with celestial brilliance, he set up a Sivalinga made of gold. Angkorian kingship. There are three ways of looking at Cambodian kingship in its heyday at Angkor. One is to study the king's relationship with Shiva. Paul Muse, in a brilliant essay written in 1933, has argued that Shiva's popularity in classical Southeast Asia may be traced in large part to his role as a spirit of the earth and also as an ancestral spirit, emerging from the earth, and thus from the ancestors, at first accidentally, in the form of an outcrop of stone, later, purposefully, carved into the shape of a lingam representing the ancestors, and later still, as representing the rulers and ancestors of a particular place. Shiva in this sense was a literary form of an ancestor spirit held responsible for fertilizing the soil by inducing rain to fall on the region under his jurisdiction. This aspect of Cambodian kingship, found elsewhere in Southeast Asia, particularly in Vietnam, endured into the 1960s in the countryside. Shiva and his consort, Uma, were gods to whom sacrifices. Buffalo or human beings were addressed because they were thought of as divinization of what lay under the earth. Intriguingly, when looked at in this way, the Cambodian king, as a patron of agriculture, resembles a Chinese emperor far more than a Raja of traditional India. The role of a Cambodian king was not merely to bring rain or to keep everyone's ancestors contentedly at bay. A second way of looking at Cambodian kingship, through the eyes of the people, is to see it in terms of the king's repeated and ritual enactment of lordliness and superiority in battle, sexuality, poetry, possessions, ceremony, and so forth. Seen in this way, the king was not an earth spirit or a priest, but the hero of an Indian epic. This is the view taken in most of the Sanskrit language inscriptions of Cambodia that praised kings as embodiments of virtue, actors living above society, associated with the sky, the sun, Indra, Vishnu, and Rama rather than with earthly or ancestral forces. As living superlatives, for each king was seen as the greatest, rather than one of many, kings provided the poets with a point of comparison, a kind of pole star from which society, flowing outward and downward, metaphorically organized itself, first through the varnas near the king, and then onto free people, rice-growing villagers, and slaves. The king was superhuman without being helpful in any practical sense. He was a hero, occupying the top of society, because of his merit and his power. To members of the Angkorian elite, this reenactment of lordliness had at least two purposes. The first was to present godlike behavior, example, building a temple mountain in imitation of Mount Meru or defeating hordes of enemies in order to obtain blessings for the king and the kingdom. The correct performance of rituals, especially exacting with regard to timing, was crucial to their efficacy. In this context, the word symbol is rather empty. The king believed in the rituals. So did his advisors. Ceremonies were the vehicles through which his lordliness, in which he also believed, was acted out. A third way of looking at kingship is in terms of everyday Cambodian life. Sanskrit inscriptions are far less useful here than the Cambodian ones. Although society at Angkor, at first glance, appears to have been almost mechanically organized into strata, the inscriptions point to webs of relationships, responsibilities, and expectations within which everyone who is mentioned appears to have been entangled. Seen in this way, the king, as a polygamist, a patron, and a giver of names, was perhaps the most entangled of them all. Ian Mabbitt's thoughtful study of Angkorian kingship shows the range of things a king was expected to do, approve, and know about. These included bestowing titles and emblems on his high officials, granting land and slaves to numerous religious foundations, constructing and maintaining irrigation works, constructing, decorating, and staffing temples, and conducting foreign relations, particularly in this era, with Kampa to the east of the capital and with various tributary states to the north and west. The king was also the court of last appeal, and the inscriptions tell us how seemingly obscure squabbles involving landholdings often floated up through the judicial system to reach him, a feature of kingship that endured into the 1960s. At the same time, although the inscriptions tell us little about it, a king had to be a political operator to survive. As Mabbitt has pointed out, many Sanskrit inscriptions praise the acumen of kings in terms of their resemblances to Rama or their knowledge of Indian political texts. As political manuals, these learned writings certainly gave Cambodian kings plenty of room for maneuver, but it is in just this area, the day-to-day preferments, quarrels, and decisions, that the inscriptions are of so little help. The flavor of life at court in Angkorian times is inaccessible. The Khmer inscriptions are of more assistance in telling us about the other levels of Cambodian society, the free people and the slaves, but again only at the moments described, recalled, or honored by an inscription. Mabbitt's study of slavery at Angkor, which builds on earlier ones by Y. Bongert and A. Chakravarti, shows the bewildering complexity of categories in use for what we would call slaves and the bewildering number of tasks that were assigned to them. As suggested in Chapter 2, it is still impossible to sort the terms out either diachronically or across the corpus of inscriptions. There are cases, for example, of slaves who owned slaves, slaves who married members of the royal family, and free people who were disposed of by others, just like slaves. Working back from later periods, one gets the impression that most of the people at Angkor were subjects, reis, rather than objects, or free people. They were at the disposition of patrons, who had the right to sell them to other people and, in many cases, they disposed of lower people themselves. In the inscriptions, slaves are listed as commodities. These people were certainly the giants who were once thought to have built Angkor. Bas-reliefs on the Bayan show us that their tools, clothing, and houses changed little between Angkorian times and the period of the French. Protectorate. The bas-reliefs also depict their domestic animals, games, and marketing in clowns, shamans, ascetics, and peddlers. We are on less firm ground, however, when we seek to reconstitute their beliefs or the stories they told each other. No popular literature can be traced back to Angkor. This absence of written sources makes it difficult to bring the ordinary people of Angkor to life, except through the things they made, the reservoirs, temples, statues of stone and bronze, tools, pottery, and so on. What did a slave at Angkor think about his master? Was a master to be imitated, hated, avoided, or revered? How far down into the society or into a person's mind did recognizably Indian ideas, gods, and vocabulary penetrate? The population was certainly more literate in Khmer than it was in Sanskrit, but nothing is known about the way literacy in either language was taught. The picture that emerges is one of familiarity with Indian culture, and perhaps knowledge of occasional Indian visitors as well, among the elite, thinning out in the rest of the society, until in the villages, as in the 19th century, we find ancestral spirits given Hindu names and Hindu statues treated as ancestral gods. As we have seen, Cambodia's imitation of India stopped short of importing the Indian caste system. As Mabat has shown in another penetrating essay, however, a set of ritual orders using Varna nomenclature formed part of the king's repertoire of patronage, for caste standing was occasionally bestowed by the monarch on his own clients or on the clients of his associates. Except at the beginning of a dynasty, a Cambodian king, like most Chinese emperors, could rule only by extending networks of patronage and mutual obligations outward from his palace, at first through close associates and family members, but becoming diffuse and more dependent on local power holders at the edges of the kingdom. Villagers far from Angkor would probably seldom have known the king's name any more than they did in the early 20th century, when the following passage was recorded by French ethnographers working among the Cambodian population of southern Vietnam. In former times there were no canals and no paths, there were only forests, with tigers, elephants, and wild buffaloes. No people dared to leave their villages. For this reason, hardly anyone ever went to the royal city. If anyone ever reached it, by poling his canoe, the others would ask him about it. What is the king's appearance like? Is he liking an ordinary man? And the traveler, seeing all these ignorant people asking questions, would reply, "The king has an elegant, beautiful appearance, unstained by dust or sweat, he has no scars." But of course, often he had never seen the king at all. Angkor, the last years of the 11th century in Cambodia, were ones of turmoil and fragmentation. At different times, two or even three monarchs contended for the title of absolute ruler. At the end of the century, however, a new dynasty, which was to last for more than 100 years, began to rule at Angkor. Little is known about the first two of its kings, Jayavarman VI and his brother, Dharanindravarman I, but their nephew, Suryavarman II, under whom Angkor what was built, was, like Yasovarman II and Suryavarman I, another unifying monarch. If his inscriptions are to be believed, he gained power while still young after winning a battle against a rival prince. Leaving the ocean of his army on the field of combat, he bounded to the head of the elephant of the enemy king and killed him, as a Garuda on the slope of a mountain might kill a snake. Suryavarman II was the first king to rule over a unified Cambodian kingdom since Udayadityavarman II's death in the 1060s. The parallels with Suryavarman I, who was probably no relation, are numerous and instructive. Both kings came to power following periods of fragmentation and disorder. They responded to this, once Yasodharapura was in their hands, with vigorous administrative policies, with a pragmatic style of kingship, and by expanding the territory and manpower under their control. Suryavarman II campaigned in the east, against Vietnam, perhaps with encouragement from China, and Kampa, using mercenaries drawn primarily from tributary areas to the west and using Khams and expeditions against Vietnam. He established diplomatic relations with China, the first Angkorian king to do so, and during his reign some impressive temples were built in what is now northeastern Thailand, including Phimai and Phnomrung. Like Suryavarman I, he also sought to separate himself in religious terms from his immediate predecessors. Suryavarman I had done this by his patronage to Buddhism, whereas his namesake chose to exhibit a devotion, unusual for a Cambodian king, to Vishnu. In both cases, innovative or personal policies went along with a legitimizing cluster of actions, which linked the kings with pre-Angkorian pilgrimage sites like Wat Phu, with gurus associated with previous kings, and with artistic styles extending back into the reigns of the people they had managed to overthrow. Suryavarman II's devotion to Vishnu led him to commission the largest, perhaps the most beautiful, and certainly one of the most mysterious of all the monuments of Angkor, the temple, tomb, and observatory now known as Angkor Wat. The temple covers an area of 200 hectares, almost 500 acres. It was begun at the start of Suryavarman II's reign, and it was not completed until after his death, which occurred in about 1150, i.e., almost a century after the previous temple mountain, the Bapuan. There is striking evidence, recently uncovered, that its central statue of Vishnu, long since vanished, was dedicated in July 1131, which was probably Suryavarman's 33rd birthday, a number with important cosmic significance in Indian religion. What is so mysterious about the temple? First, it opens to the west, the only major building at Yesodharapura to do so. In addition, its bas-reliefs, more than a mile of them around the outer galleries of the temple, are to be followed by moving in a counterclockwise direction, starting from the northwest quarter. The customary way of reading a bas-relief or of walking around a temple was to keep it all on one's right by moving in a clockwise direction, known by the Sanskrit term pradakshina. The reverse direction was usually associated with the dead, so was the west, for obvious meteorological reasons. The word for west in modern Khmer also means sink or drown. Some French scholars have argued, therefore, that Angkor Wat, unlike the other temples at Angkor, was primarily a tomb. The arguments raged in learned journals until 1940, when Coeds proposed that Angkor Wat, like 15 others royally sponsored Cambodian monuments, be thought of as a temple and a tomb. He cited stone receptacles, perhaps sarcophagi, that held part of the treasure of these other temples. As for the unusual orientation of Angkor Wat, Coeds suggested that this may have been in honor of Vishnu, Suryavarman's patron deity, often associated with the West. Angkor Wat is the only temple at Angkor that we know to have been dedicated to him. The 12th century, in fact, saw a vigorous revival of Vaishnavism, associated with popular religion, on the Indian subcontinent. This revival, it seems, like earlier ones in Indian religion, had repercussions at Angkor. Between 1940 and the 1970s, little scholarly work was done on Angkor Wat. Scholars and tourists were content to marvel at the artistry of its bas-reliefs, many of them concerned with the prowess of Rama, the delicate and yet overwhelming proportions of the temple, and its continued hold on the imagination of ordinary Cambodians. In the mid-1970s, however, Eleanor Moron began studying the dimensions of the temple in detail, convinced that these might contain the key to the way the temple had been encoded by the learned men who designed it. After determining that the Cambodian measurement used at Angkor, the hat, was equivalent to approximately 0.4 meters, 1.3 feet, Moron went on to ask how many hats were involved in significant dimensions of the temple, such as the distance between the western entrance, the only one equipped with its own causeway, and the central tower. The distance came to 1,728 hat, and three other components of this axis measured, respectively, 1,296, 867, and 439 hat. Moron then argued that these figures correlated to the four ages, or Yuga, of Indian thought. The first of these, the Krita Yuga, was a supposedly golden age, lasting 1.728 million years. The next three ages lasted for 1.296 million, 864,000, and 432,000 years, respectively. The earliest age, therefore, was four times longer than the latest, the second earliest, three times longer, and the third earliest, twice as long. The last age is the Kali Yuga, in which we are living today. at the end of this era, it is believed, the universe will be destroyed, to be rebuilt by Brahma along similar lines, beginning with another golden age. The fact that the length of these four eras correlates exactly with particular distances along the east-west axis of Angkor Wat suggests that the code for the temple is in fact a kind of pun that can be read in terms of time and space. The distances that a person entering the temple will traverse coincide with the eras that the visitor is metaphorically living through en route to the statue of Vishnu that was housed in the central tower. Walking forward and away from the west, which is the direction of death, the visitor moves backward into time, approaching the moment when the Indians proposed that time began. In her research, Moran also discovered astronomical correlations for 10 of the most frequently recurring distances at Angkor Wat. Astronomers working with her found that the sighting of the temple was related to the fact that its western gate aligned at sunrise with a small hill to the northeast. Phnom Bach. Moreover, at the summer solstice, an observer standing just in front of the western entrance can see the sunrise directly over the central tower of Angkor Wat. This day, June 21, marked the beginning of the solar year for Indian astronomers and was sacred to a king whose name, Suryavarman, means protected by the sun, and who was a devotee of Vishnu. The close fit of these spatial relationships to notions of cosmic time, and the extraordinary accuracy and symmetry of all the measurements at Angkor combined to confirm the notion that the temple was in fact a coded religious text that could be read by experts moving along its walkways from one dimension to the next. The learned people that determined the dimensions of Angkor Wat would have been aware of and would have reveled in its multiplicity of meanings. To those lower down in the society, perhaps, fewer meanings would be clear. We can assume, however, that even the poorest slaves were astounded and pleased to see this enormous temple, probably with gilded towers rising 60 meters, 200 feet, above the ground, above its glittering moat and above the thatched huts of the people who had built it. Although Suryavarman II may have led a campaign against Vietnam as late as 1150, the date of his death is unknown. In fact, the period 1145-82 produced almost no inscriptions, and its history must be recreated from later sources. Suryavarman's successor, perhaps a cousin, reached the throne under mysterious circumstances, probably in a coup d'état. This new king, Dharanindravarman, appears to have been a fervent Buddhist, although there is a possibility that he never reigned as king at Yesodharapura. Around 1150, Yesovarman II, whose reign is mentioned in one of Jayavarman II's inscriptions, succeeded him. In the inscription, Yesovarman is given credit for putting down a mysterious revolt in the northwest. The people who led this revolt, according to the inscription, were neither foreigners nor members of the elite. In bas-reliefs at the temple of Banti Chmar, they are depicted as people with animal heads. Perhaps the revolt, like the communist insurgency in the 1970s, was a supposedly unthinkable one, organized by the downtrodden segments of the society and by forest people against an allegedly unassailable elite. Instability continued in the 1160s. Yesovarman was assassinated by one of his subordinates, who then declared himself to be king. At this time also, the tributary state of Luvo sent tributary missions to China, suggesting at least partial independence from Angkor. The absence of inscriptions and the questionable legitimacy of rulers reinforced the impression of rapid change. Perhaps, as B.P. Grosslier has suggested, the hydraulic organization of the kingdom had already begun to falter during the reign of Suryavarman II. This system of reservoirs and canals, which guaranteed one harvest a year in dry times and two with adequate rainfall, was the basis of Angkor's rice-oriented agricultural economy and allowed the low-density concentration of large populations, perhaps as many as 600,000. Grosslier has suggested that the system reached peak efficiency in the mid-11th century, as the hydraulic components of Angkor Wat 100 years later were much smaller than those around earlier Temple Mountains. Indeed, Grosslier goes on, under Suryavarman II, for the first time in Cambodian history, hydraulically based cities were built at considerable distances from Angkor at Bang Maelia and Kampong Svay. Perhaps this was done because the water resources in the Angkor region, which had lasted so long, had now been tapped to the limit, although it is more likely, as recent research has revealed, that this peak was reached in the 13th century. Water came from a network of small streams, running south from the Kulin Hills to the north along the slight slope that extended to the shores of the Tunnel Sap. As demands for water increased, these streams were diverted closer and closer to their sources. This process reduced the nutrients that the streams brought to fertilize the Angkorian Plain. Because the slope of the plain is so slight, in dry periods the canals would probably have been nearly stagnant, especially if unstable political conditions, warfare, or epidemics had drawn off the labor normally used to maintain them. Grosslier has suggested, as other scholars have done, that this increasing stagnation may well have coincided with the appearance of malaria on the Southeast Asian mainland, accelerating the process. Here, as so often, we lack generalized statements about conditions at Angkor or any reliable statistics that might tell us about the size and composition of the population at a given time, the condition of the hydraulic network at particular times, and the relationship, or lack of it, between particular kings and productive agricultural life. The close relationships among water management, grain production, priesthood, and temple foundations that characterized Angkor somewhat resembles the social organization of ancient Egypt and is similar also in some respects to the Maya civilization of medieval Guatemala. In all three cases, grain surpluses of wheat, rice, or maize were collected for the benefit of the state and its prevailing ideologues, the priests, who served as patrons of temples and advisors to the kings. Rice and other products produced by temple foundations formed the basis of the Angkorian economy, buttressed by whatever could be earned from trading forest products and minerals to other states. As Michael Coe has written, there seem to have been taxes on everything on land, on rice, salt, wax and honey. Payments could be made in all kinds of goods, including slaves, buffaloes, elephants and especially cloth. The economy of Angkor is a promising field of research. Scholars concerned with the economy can build on Vickery's work on the preceding period, as well as on information gleaned by the ongoing Greater Angkor Project, centered at the University of Sydney. Thanks for listening. You will hear from me again in the next episode.